This is an interview with Jim Deeds on July 30th, 1984. The interviewer is Renee Guo. I'm going to start by asking Jim what attracted him to smoke jumping.
More than anything else, it was certainly the adventure and the money. More than anything else. Plus, the fact I was going to college, it was a good summertime job.
How old were you when you started smoke jumping?
When I first started jumping, it was, that would be 64. I was 20 years old.
Okay. What years did you jump?
Summer of 64 through the summer of 68.
Okay. So for five seasons?
Five summers.
Did your parents have any reaction to your decision about smoke jumping?
Well, not really. I have a twin brother that jumps too. And he jumps to this day. But the parents never really had any problems with it. I think they always felt that us kids were pretty much quite athletic, quite adventurous, and it never really bothered them too much.
Did you grow up in Missoula?
No. My father's retired Air Force. And we've been all over the United States. My dad finally settled and retired here in Missoula in 1959. And so I attended high school, and pretty much the rest of my time has been in Missoula.
Were you exposed to smoke jumping from living in Missoula?
Well, not really. I guess you could say to an extent. When I was swimming varsity for high school and also for the college, and Larry Nelson, who is a foreman at the Jumper Basin at that particular time, was jumping, and he was also a coach for swimming. And I guess maybe he, in a way, kind of got me started in it. I served 2 years previous to that time on fire suppression crews, one out of Rangeville, Idaho, which was the old Adams camp. And then I also served on the 9 Mile Hot Shot crew before I jumped. So I had been exposed to firefighting beforehand. And then I just decided to, I talked to Larry, and then I just decided to apply for the jumpers.
I see. What kind of training did the Smoke Jumper organization give you before you made your first jump?
In 1964, it was a 2-week, pretty intensive training. It took in everything from physical fitness, the obstacle course. We went to the jump tower. We had letdown training. Pretty much everything I think it is today.
All that training was in Missoula, is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Do you remember what your first jump was like?
Yeah, we jumped up on what was called Sherman Meadows. And I kind of liked it in a way. I didn't know what to expect. I kind of got to be one of the first ones out of the door. They were jumping two at a time. I got to be the first one in the door. So I got to stand in the door and look at it, think about it before I went. I wasn't really scared. I was, let's say, quite apprehensive as to what was going to happen. I guess you could say, not actually really butterflies, but at the same time, that awareness was there. I don't know how you explain it, but I guess in a way I was a little bit scared, but probably more apprehensive as to what was going to happen than anything else like that.
Right.
And as soon as the spotter tapped me on the leg, it was just automatic. And that was due from the training. It just, as soon as he tapped me on the leg, I can remember I just didn't hesitate. I just went out.
So did you feel pretty well prepared to make your first
I job? Felt quite prepared. Yeah, I thought they did a good job training, as far as the training is concerned.
Well, can you describe what the atmosphere in the plane was like before before the first jump.
The first jump. Well, there was a lot. It was quiet. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
And I think everybody was thinking about it, but it was definitely quiet, and I think everybody was thinking about the first jump and what was going to happen. I don't really think there was too many people that were really scared as far as being scared of going out the airplane as much as they were just, I think they were all in the same boat that I was. We were just apprehensive as far as what the jump was going to be like.
Did you ever have to use your reserve chute?
I never did. I don't ever recall even having any problems whatsoever in any of the jumps as far as chute malfunctions or anything else like that. And I can't remember to this day just exactly how many jumps I have. I know I have a 50 jump in, so I know I made 50. But I never did use any reserve or have any malfunctions.
Were you ever injured during the course of making the jump?
No, the only time that I think probably about the only time I ever came close to an injury is when I got was jumping on what was called the Bear Fire up in the Moose Creek, and I got hung up in the side of a tree, and I didn't hang up well, and I was up quite high, and it just came all the way out. I never got hung up well, and it just came all the way out, and it just really knocked the wind out of me. I remember laying on the ground for quite a period of time, but I never did get any broken bones or anything else like that.
What kind of parachute did you use?
Well, back in 64, it was all the FS-10s. It was the old 32-foot parabolics with the dairy slots.
So you did use a 32-foot parachute?
Yeah, I recall they were 30 to 32 feet at that time.
What kind of planes do you remember jumping out of?
Well, I jumped out of the Tri-Motor, the Doug.
That's a Douglas?
The DC.
DC.
The DC-2s and the 3s.
Okay.
And Twin Beaches. I jumped out of the Travel Air. And I jumped out of a Twin Otter at, let's see where they have one. Oh, they had a Twin Otter out of Silver City one time. I jumped out of a Twin Otter. I don't know. I think that's about the extent of it.
What plane did you most often jump out of?
The two or the three. Most of the time, it was always the two or the three.
Was it a problem having to adjust to jumping out of different types of planes?
No, not really. I guess the one that I liked the best was the old Ford Tri-Motor or the Traveler. They could slow those down pretty good. And I always thought that I kind of liked the Traveler because they had a little bar above it. You could just kind of kip out, you know, and just grab a hold of the bar, pick up your feet, and swing out. And the rest of them were all, like, if you jumped out of the beach, you got to, most of the time, if you were the first man, you were in the door and you had your foot out of the door on a step, and that was an easy exit. And the second man out usually was a pretty tight hole, so that was kind of a tough one to jump out of. But the other ones were all, you know, they're all, I didn't really have too much trouble adjusting to any of them.
Were you ever stationed at another base?
Well, I was stationed in Grangeville in 66 and stationed at Silver City in 67. I'd also jumped out of Winthrop, Washington as a backup crew. I went to Winthrop, Washington. I went to Redmond, Oregon, Redding, California, and I've been to McCall, Idaho. never did get one of the trips up to Alaska, which is one I really wanted to get.
Uh-huh.
And I had jumped out of West Yellowstone. That's about the extent of it.
Did you notice any different procedures at any of these bases than the one in Missoula? Or did it make you feel any differently about being based in Missoula?
No. Missoula, I think, was always the biggest base and always had the most jumpers and always had probably the, you know, most people around and stuff like that. But I think pretty much all, at that particular time, all of the jumping procedures and stuff like that were pretty much set, you know, throughout all the bases. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was anything different as far as the techniques and jumping and stuff like that was concerned, or really too much in how they packed their fire gear and stuff like that. The only thing that I do remember is that when you went to Redding, California or Redmond, Oregon, they always gave you a second letdown rope because the trees were taller.
Huh. That's interesting. What kind of on-base activities were you involved with here in Missoula when you weren't jumping?
Well, that was something that I guess I always had a problem with. If you weren't jumping, I always had, they always found something for you to do. I used to pack chutes, and so, you know, if there wasn't a fire call and we were still on job duty, they would always give us a chance to pack chutes and stuff like that. So I went through the rigor training. And, but the thing I guess that bothered me the most is if you didn't have anything to do, they always made you paint the curbs.
Uh-huh.
And those poor curbs got painted, I think, 5 or 6 times a year during one summer.
Uh-huh.
But we played volleyball. We had during lunch hour, or just right after lunch hour, we had a, we considered kind of a physical training time. We played volleyball. So we played a lot of volleyball then. But outside of that, no, they always had something for you to do. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of fire packs to be packed up and stuff like that. I think you had a little bit more of a tendency to be a little bit lax and not have so much work for you after 5 o'clock. But during the regular 8 to 5 routine, they always tried to find something for you to do.
Mm-hmm. Did you live out at the aerial fire depot during the fire season?
No, my parents lived in town, and I had an apartment, so I pretty much lived in town.
Mm-hmm.
Just ran back and forth. I went to university out here, and so I had an apartment. I pretty much stayed in an apartment, or if I gave up an apartment, you know, in the meantime, I'd stay a little bit with my folks or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of people from out of town. They didn't have a lot of room. Mm-hmm. You can only put about 60, 80 jumpers at that particular time, so it was just probably much easier for me to stay at home and find give somebody else room.
Mm-hmm. During the course of being a smoke jumper, were you able to meet a lot of the jumpers who were from other regions of the country?
Yeah, I got a chance to meet a few simply because of the fact that I spent, what was a backup crew here and there. And, of course, in a way, I felt myself as kind of an outgoing person. I always went around and introduced myself to some of the other guys. And I just figured if you were going to be there and you're going to be on their home turf, you might just as well get to know them.
Mm-hmm.
Made things a lot easier. They could always tell you where the best places to go were.
Right. Did you enjoy that aspect of the smoke jumper organization?
I did. I like to travel anyhow. And I think any time you could get out of region, I would always jump at the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was really great to get to see a little bit more of the country than to just have to jump in region 1.
Mm-hmm. Would you consider most of the smoke jumpers who jumped out of Missoula to be pretty good workers?
Oh yeah, I think there was, I think there was that certain camaraderie that you have with a group like that. It becomes a real fraternity. You know, the guys are in there, but for the adventure and the it's hard work. And you always, I don't care where you went, you always have two or three of them that just wouldn't do their part and stuff like that. I think you find that anywhere. The majority of, yeah, the majority of them were really good workers. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't even remember who did or who didn't anymore. That was too damn long ago.
Right.
But, yeah, you all, I think anywhere you go, you always have those two or three that just don't do their part. But the majority of them definitely were damn good workers. Mm-hmm. And most of them were really good people to know and to be with.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever involved with any project work out in one of the districts?
Yeah, I spent the whole summer of 1965 in the Bob Marshall Wilderness area. I only got my two refresher jumps, and then it was such a bad season, I ended up in the Bob Marshall Wilderness area on a trail crew, and I ended up being up there all year. In fact, I think I made more money that year being up there because we worked 6 days a week, 10 hours a day.
Hmm.
And built a new crew over Hon Creek, new trail over Hon Creek.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I probably fared better than most of them, money-wise.
Mm-hmm. You spent the whole summer building this trail?
Yeah. Trail maintenance and building a brand new trail over Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm. How many people were on that project?
I think there, at that time, I think there was 8 of us on that particular crew.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the only smoke jumper.
Uh-huh.
I recall I was the only smoke jumper that was up there for that time. Mm-hmm. In fact, it worked out so well, I came back out of the Bob Marshall after they closed the fire season. They flew me out, and I had made arrangements to stay in longer, so I came out and went to the university and made arrangements with the university to start classes late, and I worked clear up until the middle of October.
Wow. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, it was, I looked at it again as the aspect in terms of money,
mm-hmm.
money to go to school on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when you look at it in terms of life and what your goals are set for the winter and everything else like that, it didn't bother me to go into the hard work. I didn't
mm-hmm.
mind it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a little bit of hunting done and everything else like that while I was in here because the hunting season started in September. So it worked out well for me.
Mm-hmm.
I had no problems with it whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Did you, have you acquired many skills from project work and from your on-base activities and also from just fighting fires that you've used the rest of your life or since then, I should say?
Well, I got pretty proficient with a chainsaw. In fact, because of, I think of my efficiency with a chainsaw, I got to jump on a few rescue jumps and cutting hellespots. But yeah, I think that the use of the chainsaw taught me quite a bit. In fact, after I got out, I even did some jiffle logging, sawing here and there to make money and stuff like that to go to school on at that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, but as far as most of it was really, you know, nothing I guess you could take anywhere other than in terms of firefighting.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, after I got out, I wanted to stay away from as many fires as I could. I wanted my summers to myself.
Uh-huh.
So that was one of the good things about getting out when I did, was because of the fact that I did have my summers to myself to do other things. I would like to say that it got me in such good physical condition and stuff like that that I used to, even when I got out, I did an awful lot of hiking and backpacking. And I enjoyed the outdoors, always have enjoyed the outdoors. And to this day yet, I still do an awful lot of backpacking.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if nothing else, then I've got out of it more than anything else. I've got a real love for the outdoors and an appreciation for the outdoors. And so I think that's probably the biggest benefit that I ever got out of smoke jumping.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the fact of being in the outdoors and seeing so much country and loving it and developing a real appreciation for the outdoors.
Mm-hmm. Would you use chainsaws to cut down trees on most fires?
Yeah, it depends upon the situation. You know, you always have, a lot of times you got a lightning strike and stuff like that would hit a tree, mm-hmm. and that's where your fire would start from. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't necessarily, you know, consume the whole tree or anything else like that. It would just start in the top of the tree, and then the lightning would run down the tree and start a fire on the ground. But you always had that little bit of fire in the tree, and in order for that fire to be completely out, you had to knock that tree down. Mm-hmm. Which brings to mind a time that my twin brother and I dropped on a two manor, and we fought quite a bit on that fire. I was the older jumper. I started in 64 and he started in 1965. Mm-hmm. And this particular incident was when we were both jumping out of Greensville, Idaho in 66. We jumped on what was called the K Creek Fire. Mm-hmm. And we jumped from the Ford Trimotor, and we argued about who was going to be the fire boss.
Huh.
And so I told him, I said, well, you realize that the procedure has always been that the older jumper is the fire boss and the new jumper is just the helper. So we argued about it. So finally I told him, I said, well, you go ahead and be the fire boss. It sure isn't worth arguing about. So it was quite a hilarious incident because after it was all over, we ended up having a reburn. Hmm. And that's a no-no. Forcers. But he wanted to be the fire boss, so he got to be the fire boss, but he wouldn't climb the trees, and all the equipment got hung up in a couple of tall white pines.
Can you tell me exactly what the fire boss does that the other smoke jumper wouldn't do?
Pretty much the fire boss makes a decision on what's going to happen.
Okay.
Like, for instance, if a tree has been hit by lightning, the fire boss is going to make the decision as to whether that tree comes down or whether it stays. You know, mm-hmm. If you can look at it and keep a good eye on it, and you have a good idea, or you're pretty much positive the fire is out of the tree, you might decide to leave it. Mm-hmm. I always felt that the safest thing to do was to drop it come hell and high water, because mm-hmm. you know, there's a possibility something's there. But, mm-hmm. but he makes those decisions. He decides when the fire, consider the fire completely out and it's time to leave. Mm-hmm. You control the fire, get the fire under control by putting your line around it. Once your line is around it and you feel you've got a good stable line, then you can consider the fire under control. Mm-hmm. Then comes the mop-up stage. That's when you have to put out all the small little hot spots and stuff like that. You have to make sure the fire is completely out cold. Mm-hmm. Then you can leave. And usually when the fire is out, they required you at that time to stay over the next burning period, which was probably from 8 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So if you got the fire out at, say, 9 o'clock at night, that night, you'll still stay on it to make sure it's dead out through the next burning period. Mm-hmm. And, well, see, it's the fire bosses decide whether what he considers it out or anything else like that, and then it's time to leave. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we argued about that for a while. He didn't really want to climb the tree for the gear, so I ended up climbing the tree for the gear. When we got down, we found out that our cross-cut saw was broken, so we couldn't bring that big white pine down. And so he wanted to call back to Grangeville and have the plane bring out a chainsaw. And I wasn't for it. I figured there was a way we could get that down one way or another because mm-hmm. of the cost. And putting a plane in the air just to bring the chainsaw. Mm-hmm. Well, we ended up leaving it. And that was his decision to leave it. And it ended up, was a two-manner. It ended up, they jumped 31 men on it next time.
Huh.
So it was a tremendous cost to the Forest Service because of our mistake. Mm-hmm. And I will have to admit, he was really good. He went to the regional office there, or to the forest office, and explained to him that it was his fault, was his decision to leave it. But it was kind of hilarious. After that, they never jumped brothers together on fire. So that was 1966.
Hmm. Well, what other ways would have you taken that tree down?
Well, even if I had to take whittle the handle for a crosscut saw, I would have done it. There was a way, you know, we could have mm-hmm. used that crosscut saw. You know.
Right.
It might have been a jury rig type thing, mm-hmm. But, you know, the way I looked at it, even if we'd have stayed over another whole day or something like that, it would have cost them a lot less than bringing up another plane all 30-some men out.
Right.
So there was, we could have figured out some way of getting mm-hmm. that tree down with that cross cut. That mm-hmm. wasn't a problem to me. It was just the fact that, you know, I kind of had the feeling at that particular time Jack was kind of new and stuff like that, and he wasn't really gung-ho for work.
Mm-hmm.
But we argued about that one, and he's come a long ways and stuff like that since then. But that was a bad one. That was the only time we ever had trouble together, and after that we never jumped together on a fire, unless it was a project fire in which we jumped, you know, 8 or 10 guys, and then we had a foreman on.
Mm-hmm.
So they never jumped us
mm-hmm.
after that on a two-man fire together.
Did you know of any other brothers who were jumping at the same time?
Not at the same time Jack and I were jumping. I understand a little bit later there was a couple of brothers came in and jumped together. And I never did get to meet them mm-hmm. until one night I was sitting in the Silver Dollar, and one of them was really upset with me. Oh, you're the other one of the Deeds brothers that kept brothers from jumping together, and he was half drunk, and you can't believe the amount of trouble I got that night.
Uh-huh.
So I said, I the only thing I could say was, I'm sorry, you know, it isn't worth fighting over or anything else like that, so let's just drop it.
Yeah,
it was probably, believe it or not, it was probably a good thing that they come out with that particular ruling or whatever. But
mm-hmm. why do you feel it isn't such a good idea for brothers to jump together?
Well, not that everybody's the same as my twin brother and I are,
mm-hmm.
or anything else like that. But I don't know. I think in a way, one way or another, brothers are competing against themselves all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that competition comes in several different forms. You know, maybe one wants to be the boss, the other one doesn't want to be, you know, and that's where arguments come in and stuff mm-hmm. like that. I think it's probably in the long run, it was just better to not have brothers to jump, particularly in our case. And I wished I had said something about it before the two of us had made the jump, because I knew for a fact that my twin brother and I had argued all of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we get along real well right now, but you know, we still have our times where we argue and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong, I think I love my brother and everything else like that, but well, brothers will be brothers, I guess. That's the way
right.
you put it.
Right. You mentioned having made several rescue jumps and using chainsaws during them. Can you tell me some more about them?
Well, I remember two of them, you know, in particular. One of them was the time that it was Dave Evenson that got... I jumped on a fire in the Clearwater, and I can't remember just the extent of his injuries, but he got injured on that, and I think he got some low back injuries and maybe a broken collarbone. I don't remember just exactly the extent of his injuries, but I got the opportunity to jump on that one and cut a hill of spot. And then I also jumped on one. That was probably, I jumped on one on the south side of the Salmon River. I don't remember the year or the date, but I do remember it was a helicopter crash in which the helicopter pilot was bringing in a geological survey crew to survey down there. And I don't remember what caused the accident or anything else like that, but I remember the helicopter crashed, and the pilot was in pretty bad shape, and they jumped us that evening, and the winds were really bad, and that was probably the jump that I got the scaredest on,
mm-hmm.
if anything, because the winds were pretty bad and a lot of us got blown all over the country, and there were some damn big rocks.
Hmm.
And I remember just barely coming down between a couple of pretty good sized boulders, and I just figured I was going to get hurt. So, but anyway, that's probably the worst jump that I can recall having mm-hmm. because of the winds.
Mm-hmm.
The winds blew us, oh, I would say probably a good mile away from the damn jump spot and stuff like that. And we were scattered out pretty heavy, and there was I don't remember just exactly how many of us jumped, whether it was 16 or how many, but it was quite a bunch of us jumped, and we were scattered throughout pretty bad. And it ended up, the helicopter pilot died anyhow, but we cut a hella spot, and I got saw on that one, cut a hella spot to get those people on.
Mm-hmm. Was your only responsibility on those rescue jumps to cut a hella spot, or were you also expected to help with some?
We got to help. You know, we were expected to help with those that were pretty good in first aid, help with the first aid and stuff like that. But in particularly a lot of the cases, you know, they had guys that were a lot better with first aid and stuff like that mm-hmm. than I was, and most of those guys did the work. But well, they always had other guys come along to help haul the individuals, because a lot of times maybe it was 2 miles, 3 miles to the nearest place where you could cut a decent heli spot, and then we had to carry the individual to that particular spot.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's when they needed most of the guys to help spell off, you know, carrying the individual mm-hmm. any distance,
mm-hmm.
Particularly uphill and stuff like that. Don't climb a lot of that Salmon River country without getting awful tired, just without carrying somebody, without having to carry somebody. So that was a lot of it was to work on the individual. And there was always jobs for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
All the equipment had to be retrieved and everything else like that, and bundled up, sacked up, ready to take out.
Mm-hmm.
So there was plenty of work for everybody. But, yeah, usually what they did, most of the times I got to do a lot of sliding.
Mm-hmm. How far away was the most distant fire you remember jumping?
In terms of having to walk?
In terms of...
Farthest from Missoula?
Farthest from Missoula.
Without going out of reaching, I would say I jumped on one in... clear out of what was called Sabe Creek. It was clear down on the Magruder District.
And that is?
It's back in the Bitterroot Zone.
Okay.
As far as in terms of walking, I would say it would be that Bear Creek fire, in which we had to, we probably hiked 15 miles just to Moose Creek, and then from then on it was, and all Moose Creek is a ranger district back in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
It has an airstrip in there.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the longest walk, I would say probably the Bear Creek fire.
So you're a spotter, so you jumped.
Well, I wouldn't have to say from Missoula. I'd have to say probably would be the ones down on the Salmon River. That would be the furthest from Missoula.
Mm-hmm. When you had to hike all those miles into the fire, was that because there was no place for you to jump close to the fire? Or?
No, that's hiking out.
Oh, hiking out.
When you come out of a fire.
Right, okay.
No, I think the largest distance that I had to hike to a fire was probably 4 miles. Simply because it was so, you know, the terrain was such that you couldn't get close to the fire. And when we did jump on that one, I jumped with a two-manner with Gary Anderson down, and that was that Sabe Creek fire.
Mm-hmm.
Was down there near Sabe Creek someplace. And it ended up, we ended up jumping quite a ways from the fire. And then in reproduction, and what we mean by reproduction is just new trees that are growing up. They're fairly short so that you can jump into them. And they're usually very thick
mm-hmm.
so that you can always generally get hung up in them without any trouble, but not a big letdown. And we jumped on that one, and we never did find the fire. Because it rained, so we jumped, and then it rained that night, and it rained pretty hard, and it was just a small fire then.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to walk a trail down into the draw, and then we just couldn't find the fire. So we ended up staying out there 2.5 days in the rain, just looking for the damn thing. But we never did find it, and we ended up going back and sacking up our gear just walking out and leaving it. Never ever came up again, so evidently the rain had put it out probably the first night, and we just never could find it.
Right.
We climbed trees and everything else like that, looking for the smallest smoke and everything else like that, and we never could find any. So we ended up sitting in the rain.
Wow. What do you think is the biggest fire you've ever fought?
Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
I was over. I was a sector boss on the Sundance Fire over in Idaho.
And exactly where in Idaho was that, and what year was it?
That started at Priest Lake and went almost to Bonner's Ferry. It was between that. It was. I believe it was 128,000 acres. I don't remember just exactly. These are the pictures of it right here. I think I remember taking these as I was in the helicopter, going up and looking over my section. Yeah, there it is right there.
Mm-hmm.
Those four pictures. Everywhere you look, there's nothing but chart.
Right. What exactly was your duty on this fire?
Well, I was just given a crew, and I was, they broke your fire line up into different sections.
Mm-hmm.
And they put a sector boss in charge of each section of that particular fire line.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was a sector boss of a certain section of fire line with so many crews to, so many people just to make lines and to bring it under control. And they pretty much had it fairly well under control. They just had a few hot spots and stuff like that were going up. I recall one, I had one hot spot on my section where there was a bunch of or they put the fire line and everything else like that, and it wasn't good, substantial fire line, and it all of a sudden started, and there was still some greens, good trees, and a good bunch of trees inside, and they started picking up again, so I was a little worried about that, so I remember calling for a retardant drop, because it had picked up pretty bad,
mm-hmm.
and I was just afraid the line wasn't real substantial at that particular section, so I wanted to make sure it got knocked down before I got a chance to approve that line.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a chance to approve the line.
Were there quite a few firefighters and smoke jumpers who worked on this fire?
Well, the fire originally started with two jumpers jumping on it. And they got it under control. And what my understanding was is that the Idaho Protective Association came in, which was the state crew, started on state land, I guess. Came in, and their policy was at 5 o'clock their work day was done and they left the fire. Well, it ended up blowing up again, and they jumped a bunch more jumpers on it, and the same thing happened, and then it ended up jumping in, becoming a 128-acre fire.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the smoke jumpers went in as sector bosses and in charge of air operations and stuff like that. You know, a lot of the jumpers that had quite a bit of experience,
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that were called in to be sector bosses and in charge of air operations and different other operations.
Mm-hmm. As a Forest Service employee, are you or were you able to jump on any fire on any land, or exactly How was that?
A lot of times what happened, most of the time we just jumped on Forest Service land. I think most of the state land was accessible in the fact that they could get crews in easier by truck or something like
mm-hmm.
that. The whole purpose of smoke jumping was initial attack to try to get in while they were small
mm-hmm.
and keep them small. Occasionally, you got a fire that was getting pretty heavily out of control or something like that on state land, or a lot of times you jumped on BLM land, you'd jump on state land, you'd jump on Park Service land, a few jumps in Glacier Park, a few in Yellowstone Park, you got to jump on Indian land, the reservation. The reservations, that anybody could call for jumpers if they needed them.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they'd be footing the bill,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, it wasn't just the fact that we were restricted to federal land or
right.
anything else like that.
Okay. What do you remember as being the toughest fire you ever fought?
Well, it was one I was trucked to, I think, out of Cody, Wyoming. I don't recall just the exact acreage when we got on it, but it must have been about 20, 40, 50 acres, something like that. And there was predicted extreme high winds for the area and stuff like that. And so we built some really big 50-foot fire line. And we built some really wide fire line. And of course the winds picked up and didn't hold it. That wide line didn't hold it. And I recall a bunch of us, it got away from us, and we ended up on a damn ledge. And I remember the slurry planes coming in and dropping retardant on us instead of the fire. And I can't even remember the year or anything like that. But I've been looking around for the pictures because I remember taking my camera. And I was supposed to be having my head down with the slurry planes coming in, trying to get some pictures. And there was a good 100, 150 foot wall plane behind us. And the planes were coming in and dropping us and dropping it on the edge of the fire there. But we just took chainsaws, everything, and just started dropping it into the fire. And then we, as soon as it started getting close, then we just moved back out to the ledge. And I can't remember who all was on that one either.
What kind of a ledge was it? You weren't being, like, pushed off.
No, it's just the fact that it was a big rock ledge. Uh-huh. And it dropped down, but it was the only place that there was no fuel.
Right.
Where this fuel was so sparse, and we figured it was the only place we could go, so we just took our chainsaws, and we got out to the ledge there, and we started knocking everything back towards the fire, mm-hmm. and trying to give us as much room as we possibly could out there for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just kind of hunkered down on the rocks and stuff like that, which is the safest place to go is any natural break and stuff like that, which is, we figured was the safest place. There's too much timber to go anywhere else, really. Mm-hmm.
Were you, did you have very much fear of being surrounded by fire or of the fire itself?
Well, no, I never really thought of it that way, because we always took pretty good precautions. We always had, if it was any kind of a big project fire or a pretty good size, fire where we dumped 30 guys or something like that on it, we always had one guy as a lookout. His job was to go around and look and see what the fire was doing, and if it looked like it was getting out of control or trying to swing around us, or if a spot fire had started below us or something like that, was his job to make sure that nobody got caught in the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never really worried too much about it.
Did you ever work as a spotter or a pilot?
No, I kicked some cargo, but I never really did any spotting. That was mostly for the guys that were squad leaders and foremen did most of the spotting.
Mm-hmm.
I kicked cargo, but that's about all, and pack chutes.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a lot of confidence in your spotter?
Oh, yeah, I never had any problems with any of them.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when the guys go through that spotter training and stuff like that, I think they do a thorough job.
Mm-hmm.
I think the whole organization has always done a thorough job. There again, with my ability, just on my first jump to go up there, I felt that I had enough good training that it didn't really bother me.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me what to look out for and everything else like that, and so I just never really had any fear. I had no problems with any of the spotters. I don't ever recall any spotter putting me in a bad situation.
Mm-hmm. Of the equipment that you would use and have brought to you while fighting a fire, how much of that was disposable, and were you able to leave behind at the time?
When I first started, there was a lot of gear left behind.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of gear left behind. We never left any chutes or anything else like that.
Mm-hmm.
Those were always brought out, always retrieved and brought out.
Mm-hmm.
We always brought out most of the shovels and stuff like that. But, the containers from food things and stuff like that, we dug a hole and buried it and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that. We'd even leave our water containers, and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
that were empty and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But as it got towards the end of the years that I was jumping, then it pretty much got to be pack in and pack out.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember packing out chainsaws that were pretty heavy and stuff like that. And I mean, when we got to the point where I was talking everything, I think Lady Bird Johnson was the one that started all that.
Huh.
But it ended up being that towards the end, the last couple of years, yeah, we packed up most everything. Mm-hmm.
I understand that at some point the Forest Service was using disposable or burnable sleeping bags. Did you ever use
Yeah,
those?
Paper sleeping bags, yep. Mm-hmm. We just either buried them or burned them.
Mm-hmm. And you said that...
They had to... there was a lot of, you know, actually they had quite a few disposable things. All your food containers and stuff like that. Of course, skin you never brought back. You just dug a hole and buried it and stuff like that. Actually, when I first got started, probably about the most of the things that we brought back out were flasking, shovel, crosscut saws, tools. Mm-hmm. Tools and flashlights and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We brought most of that stuff back. Sleeping bags, eating utensils and stuff like that, you just bury.
Mm-hmm. Would you use a chainsaw on most of the fires that you fought, or would you use crosscut saws more of the time?
Well, most of the fires that I jumped on were, I jumped on a lot of two-manners. Mm-hmm. And see, on two-manners, they don't even drop you a chainsaw, they just drop you a crosscut saw. Mm-hmm. So most of the time, I would say I used a crosscut saw, although I did get on some bigger fires where I used chainsaws.
This is side two of an interview with Jim Deeds on July 30th, 1984. The interviewer is Renee Guo. You mentioned at the beginning of the interview that you were a student while you were smoke jumping. Were most of the other people who were jumping at that time also students?
Yeah, I think they were either students or teachers or people that had jobs that during the winter, full-time jobs during the winter, and that had a particular job that didn't have summer employment. And so they jumped in the summertime. There was a lot of kids that, when I was going to school and jumping, that had the same idea that I did, which was with money to put them through college.
Mm-hmm.
Was, you couldn't find a better job to go to college and make money in the summertime.
Right.
The amount of hours that you got, you put in an awful lot of hours in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And you made some real good money. I can recall a lot of times putting $700 away in the bank to go to school, huh? Lord knows how much I spent for bars.
That's great. How much money did you make? Were you paid by the hour? Do you remember
that? We were paid by the hour then. I can't recall just exactly how much it was. I think if a person was to work on it, boy, I just don't recall now. But I think if a person was to work in just a regular 40-hour work week, he wouldn't make much more than probably bring home much more than $100 a week. You know, it wasn't big money at that time, but the thing that was, you got a lot of hours.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thing. And a lot of people thought that maybe a person got paid time and a half at that time. No, you didn't. You got paid straight time.
Hmm.
But where you made your money was until the fire was controlled, you worked 24 hours around the clock.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you got to sneak in a little bit of sleep time here and there and everything else like that. But principally, you got paid for 24 hours until the fire was under control, and then for the next day or two, you got paid 16 hours a day. So it was good money.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of hours and good money.
Mm-hmm. How many hours were you allowed to work continuously without a break?
Well, now, I think I don't recall, but I think they let you go about 32 to 48 hours. I think, you know, that continuous, and then they required a break.
Mm-hmm.
The thing was, you know, a lot of times you wouldn't have the fire under control. You'd work awful damn hard for maybe the first 20 hours or something like that. And then you'd finally reach a spot where the fire wasn't really too bad in that particular area. So you took the opportunity to take a little bit of time off and sleep and stuff like that. So I don't think there was anybody that ever worked, you know, if you want to call it continuous 24-hour mm-hmm. day. I don't think there was anybody that ever did that.
Mm-hmm.
There was always a break in there someplace where maybe a few of us would work and a few of them would sleep and switch off and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Uh,
Do you have any feelings about the change in the composition of people who are smoke jumpers today, from being students to a lot of smoke jumpers being sort of career jumpers?
No, I think everybody picks his own way. I have no objections to it. I have no problems with, you know, somebody becoming a career jumper. If I can take my brother, for instance, he started jumping the year after I did, and he jumps right up to this day. I have a little bit of problems with his attitude. I have a little bit of problems with some of his attitude. Some of them think that it's a, you know, you're really a macho individual if you're a smoke jumper. I guess maybe that's their thing. My idea of it was that it was a good summertime job. It was a job that had to be done. Sure, there was a lot of adventure in it. But it, my life did not evolve around smoke jumping. Like I think some of the people do, like my brother right now. I think my brother to this day, his life revolves around smoke jumping. And there's where I think the mantra comes into it. I think some of the younger kids today are into it for the fun. And not the work they're going to. So I think that's probably about the extent of it. You know, I think that as far as career people, there are some damn good people out there that make it a career. Larry Eisner is in charge of the project now. Damn good smoke jumper. Damn good foreman. Damn good at his job. He knows it. Knows it well. They could have picked probably a better person to put into it. Some of the other guys, I think they're into it just for the mantra that goes with it.
Do you think the level of expertise is increased by having people come back year after year like they are now, or do you think that that is really a very significant?
Well, I don't think, I think the level of expertise is always better when you bring a person in back who knows the job and things like that. I think you would never get the level of quality of work if you had to train new smoke jumpers every year. I think that as far as jumping is concerned, I think it's like anything. It's the attitude of the individuals. I'm sure there's still guys coming back year after year that probably are no better than they were when they first started. But I think that's the same with any organization. I think once you train an individual gets a handle on what he's doing and he develops any kind of pride in it, and I think the majority of the people, after, particularly after going to this reunion and seeing some of it's a tremendous fraternity, it really is. It's, you know, and it's a unique organization, it's a unique bunch of guys, and the majority of them are hard workers. They know their job, they know it well, and so, yeah, I think that coming back year after year is a benefit to the organization because of the cost of training, because you're getting an individual that's got experience, who knows the job. So I think, I think the fact that it's a benefit to guys to come back year after year. I think there's some guys there that just, you know, I don't know if they're trying to think that it could be a full-time job or not. I know that a lot of the smoke jumpers, that when they get done, go to elsewhere on the forest. You know, they can go to the forest as a fire control officer, or they do something like that, which is a benefit to the forest because they do have that experience in firefighting.
Were many of the people that were students when you smoke jumped, were they forestry students?
I was. I think there was a few of them around that were forestry students.
Do you think that smoke jumping helped to further your career in as a forestry major and other people's?
To an extent, yes. Largely, no. Because really, if a person is in timber management or range management or wood utilization or you know what have you, you don't get much benefit out of smoke jumping because you're mainly in fire control. Mm-hmm. That's it. You don't get an opportunity unless you maybe by chance get on some particular project in a district where you can use your schooling or something like that. But outside of that, no, I don't think smoke jumping really helps your forestry at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would say that probably very little.
Mm-hmm. Have there been any changes that you know of in regard to fire management that the Smoke Jumper organization has adopted since you were jumping?
Gone out and really been extremely close to the project since I quit. I've gone on and devoted my time to, I think, things that are more important to me than to paying attention to what's going on out there. But certainly there has been some really good changes. I remember the first year that I jumped, they used bentonite and stuff like that as their fire retardant, which now they've gone to Phos-Check and some of those stuff like that, which not only is it a good retardant, but it's also a fertilizer and stuff like that. Where if I remember right, I think bentonite actually sterilized the soil. Now they've come to some things now where they've got everything computerized. I think new technology and stuff like that is involved in this and everything else like that just as much as it is in any other big business. I'm sure that they've really tremendously upgraded their organization as far as, they've brought in some new chutes, experimental chutes, and the chutes are even better than they were in those days. Brought in the inversion net, which eliminates a lot of malfunctions. In fact, I think now with the inversion nets, your line overs and stuff like that are virtually eliminated. And so, sure, no doubt about it. I don't know very many of them. I haven't really spent a lot of time out there.
Did a let burn policy ever exist when you were a smoke jumper?
I don't recall of it then. I don't recall of there being any fires that they actually just let go out of control like they do now in the wilderness areas. I know there's some of the wilderness areas where you can get some pretty good sized burns simply because of the fact that they're just going to let them go.
As a former smoke jumper, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think I really honestly believe that in some areas I think it's good. Really good. I think that we get to the point where, you know, as soon as your mature trees come in and take over, by then you've lost a lot of your vegetation for your animals and stuff like that. And a burn does nothing better but to bring a lot of good wildlife vegetation and stuff like that. It's like any other ecosystem. As it progresses and stuff like that, as you get into the top part of the ecosystem and stuff like that, you eliminate your lower. And as you get a big mature canopy and stuff like that, you get no undergrowth for your elk and deer and stuff like that to feed on. So I believe it's good. It depends upon what they want to do. There's a lot of good merchable timber then that goes by the wayside too. So it's a six of one, half a dozen of another. I haven't thought about forestry for quite a few years. Since I've been in the environmental chemistry end of it, I haven't really done a lot of thinking about it. But, it's a basic trade-off. There again, it's a trade-off. But then here again, you get back in your wilderness areas, how much of that merchable timber is going to be sold? How much, you know, there's not going to be any forest logging in there anyhow, so.
Were there any women smoke jumpers when you were a smoke jumper?
None. I don't think the first woman jumper came in, I think, along in 1981. Back at the reunion, I think they gave the first woman jumper a plaque recognizing the fact that now women jumpers are in there. And your next question is going to be, how do I feel about it? I have absolutely no qualms whatsoever about women being in soap jumping. I have no problems with women being in any job that a man has, as long as she can handle it and she can admit it if she can't. Mm-hmm. I have seen jobs where women have been in jobs that they just can't handle and just refuse to admit it. And then what ends up happening is somebody else gets them carrying them. Mm-hmm. And when somebody else carries them, then there's hard feelings come along. And there are women, don't get me wrong, that can handle most any job a man can handle. Mm-hmm. And I recognize that, more power to them. Mm-hmm. They can have, if a woman can take over my job and she's got capable and she's smarter than I am, then fine, she deserves it. And I feel that person's got to move on. Mm-hmm. You either fight to hold your job or you lose it. You know? Yeah. And I don't have any problems with giving it up to anybody. Mm-hmm. Male, female, whatever.
Are there any other transitions in the Smoke Jumper organization that you'd like to comment on that you've noticed or are aware of?
I have a little bit of a problem with the union out there. I don't know whether the fact that the union is good or bad for the Smoke Jumper program.
How long has a union existed for Smoke Jumpers?
I don't know. I've just heard about it, and I've just really never really got with anybody and talked to them about it or anything else like that. But if it's like any other union, I have problems with unions. Mm-hmm. I think unions are good. I think unions have outstepped their bounds. As far as the Smoke Jumper program is concerned, I don't know how strong it is. I don't know how strong it is. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it's run. I don't know what effect it has on the individuals out there. But usually unions have a tendency to fight for the deadheads and causes a weak organization. In mm-hmm. And so that's the reason I have a problem with it. But there again, I don't know to what extent that union is or anything else like that. But if it's like a lot of the other unions that I've seen and stuff like that, I think it's a disadvantage. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel, when you were a smoke jumper, that you had a fair amount of freedom on the job to use your own judgment without having to necessarily go by, say, a contract guideline that was laid out for you? Do you feel like that made some of that freedom and of judgment is going to be reduced by something?
Well,
like
to be
that.
Absolutely honest with you, when I was on a two-man fire or something like that, I handled it the best way I thought I could handle it. Mm-hmm. I didn't care about guidelines or anything else like that.
Right.
I felt that I was out there to do a job. And I felt that, by gosh, if they put me on the fire, that they had enough confidence in me to take care of it in my way. You know, so I just took care of it the best way I knew how. And I never had any problems with it. I think, really, the way the program was structured at the time I was there, it was fairly well structured. Starting from the beginning, they gave you really good training. I think the training was really great. And that built that confidence in you to be able to jump. Mm-hmm. And the same way with your fire training. They taught you every technique that they had in fighting fires. And I thought that was good. So I felt that, you know, that every individual that came through the door out there and became a smoke jumper, I think majority of those people that were up in the higher echelon had all the faith in the world in those people. And they felt that their training was good enough, that you went out and you did the job. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there was really anything really strong about structured lines. I think mm-hmm. when you got out, you had a job to do. They didn't care how you did it. Mm-hmm. They just wanted the job done. Mm-hmm. And so I never felt that I was really pressured to do a job any particular way or anything else like that. Mm-hmm. When you got on the job with a foreman or something like that, Yeah, they generally made the decisions and stuff like that as to where the line would go and stuff like that. But, you know, everybody still knew how to take the line and stuff like that. There wasn't really anything to it.
Has your smoke jumping experience had a significant impact on your life?
Oh, yeah. You know, here again, I guess the fact that I was out smoke jumping and the fact that I was out fighting fires and had the opportunity to see Montana and, well, in fact, to see most of the damn the wilderness in from, you know, everything Montana west of the coast and stuff like that, and haven't jumped in many different places. I just had a tremendous love for the outdoors, and to this day, I still spend as much time as I possibly can in the outdoors. There's nothing I'd rather do than to just put a backpack on and go backpacking. You know, and it really has, you know, I appreciate what we've got here now. More than anything else, I think it's the appreciation for what we have. If I see somebody, well, I'll just recall, I remember stopping at a road construction, and this guy in front of me just hauled out, threw a piece of paper out of his car window, and I walked over and got that piece of paper and threw it back in his window, you know? I love Montana, and I love the outdoors, and I don't want anybody else to mess it up for me. I have a real appreciation for it, and I think that smoke jumping and having the opportunity to see a lot of this country has had a tremendous effect on me in that respect.
Are there any other experiences or stories that you've that you have from your time as a smoke jumper that you'd like to talk about?
Well, there isn't really too many. I guess a lot of the times I got small fires. The only really big fires that I got was the one in Cody, Wyoming, which we got kind of trapped out there on that ledge a little bit. The Sundance fire. I don't think I was a jumper, but I remember when I was working on one of the hot shots, it was one of the most hilarious things I ever seen in my life, is when the jumpers were dropping cargo, and they were dropping these 5-gallon water cans. And 3 of the 5-gallon water cans broke away from one of the chutes and landed right next to the mules. The mules were right by next to the cook tent. And that was on the Alder Ridge fire. And boy, I'll tell you, talk about a rodeo.
I bet.
When those water cans broke and sprayed water all over those mules went wild, went right through the damn cook tent area. But I wasn't jumping, man. I think that was the year just before I started jumping. So, but, and I was on one fire, which was pretty hairy one time, and they were over in Helena. They were jumping on fire over in Helena. They had the old C-47. And I think a lot of us, when we jumped out of that damn airplane, couldn't decide whether you wanted to jump over the tail or under the tail. The tail stood right about even with the bottom of the door. And so when you looked out over the top of the tail. And they were dropping cargo, and cargo sliced right through the tail, and we had to end up flying all the way back to Helena with that cargo sliced through, hanging in the tail there. Most of my jumping experiences were quite mild. I didn't get in on a lot of the stories like a lot of other guys did. Although my jumping experience was a tremendous experience. I enjoyed every minute of it. I had it was good hard physical work, which I think, you know, it really never hurts anybody. I guess in a way it did give me an attitude towards my work too. I still to this day I think I work hard. It was a great organization to be in, some really good individuals to work with. I still think back about the years that I jumped and the adventure that I had jumping out of airplanes and some of the fires that I've been on, but I just didn't get too many of the good fires you hear everybody talking about. Which is no problems. I thought it was quite an incredible experience the day that I jumped with my twin brother. You know, that in a way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So everybody has their own little thing, I guess, that they experience. And that was, I guess that was enough of an experience when we were on Cody, Wyoming. I guess that was, I wished I could remember some of the guys that were on that fire, because I remember we didn't jump on it. We ended up, not that I recall anymore, we didn't jump on it. We got ended up getting trucked to it. And but it ended up blowing on us. That's about as close, I guess, I ever came to a hairy fire as anything. And I do recall the first fire jump that I got up at Parsnip Mountain, up on the Kootenai National Forest, up out of Libby, in which I think a dug load of 16 of us jumped on the upper edge of the fire. Before it was all over, nobody got hurt or anything else like that, those that jumped up on top. Before we got over, the fire got into our chutes and burned up our, a bunch of our jump gear. Hmm. And some of them jumped at the bottom end of the fire, and that was the ones that got hurt. Mm-hmm. A few of those guys got hurt because they jumped into what looked to be reproduction. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot taller than it was, and it had covered up a whole bunch of downfall. And some guys got broken arms and legs, and one or two of them, I think, got some back injuries and stuff like that. But no, it really, I guess I was quite one of the mild smoke covers.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank Jim Deed for sharing his experiences with me today. This is the end of this tape.